boy. My name is Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and I'm very grateful. I'd like to thank Tracy for asking me to come up here. She's like a human butterfly or a hummingbird or something. She never sits. At least not this weekend she hasn't. And I think she probably should take a day or two off or something and sit down, get used to sitting. She makes me tired. So I want to thank her because she's always she's very nice to me, and that's always pleasant. And Brenda for being here, and her mom. I got to meet her mom tonight. Brenda's mom is here, and my beloved husband of 45 years, is it 46? I never can keep track of that, but it's 46, he informs me. We have both trudged the road of happy destiny, but I don't sponsor him. I would like to. And I think I would do a fine job. I could put my finger on the real nugget of the problem. He doesn't sponsor me either, although he believes he could do a good job too, I'm sure. When I got here, I asked I don't remember who it was I asked, maybe Tracy, how many people generally attended this? I think it was Terry. And he said he thought that it was up to something like 600 and something. And we have 1,000 people. That is really encouraging. That's a very encouraging sign, because Alcoholics Anonymous went through a period of time where it was really shrinking. And I really got discouraged about who was going to be here to take care of the newcomers, because, the best, Rich is, and he spoke last night, and I know Rich, and I'll see him again in 2 weeks. He's coming to Omaha for our Christmas party. And, those people who are around 8 to 10 years sober are just on fire with AA, and so am I. I am too, spiritually. I am on fire with AA, always have been. But I'm 73, for God's sake. And I can't do what I did before. I can't, my body won't be on fire anymore. It says, whoa, where's the extinguisher? And so I've been, Dick and I both, and many of the other people here in the room, Chuck, Terry, Brenda, tons of you people have been at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. For years we've been at the door. We've been, figuratively speaking, at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, welcoming people, greeting people. I think a greeter is one of the most important jobs that there is in AA, because if I have been to places in this country where I could walk into a meeting, and I was frequently at those places, a person who had the most sobriety in the room, and no one said a word to me. Nothing. Now, it didn't bother me because I'm not new. But what if I had been somebody brand new walking into that room and scared to death as I was when I first walked in? How would they feel if we didn't reach out and make them welcome at least? And so I think greeters are just great. And we're such goofs, we're all sorts of different people. We all have stories to tell, and they're all different and strange. We have strange things that we do, but we understand each other, and we welcome each other, and we make each other feel as though they're all right. Because all of my life, I felt like I had something wrong with me. There was just something wrong with me. Like I came from a different planet or something. You know, I didn't think that really. But I thought, I always had this feeling, if they really knew, they'd all run screaming out of this room, going, there she is, that weird one over there, you know. Because I felt that way. I felt that way about myself. And I had no real proof of that, but I know now that what it is I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm an alcoholic of the worst variety. And usually people who come to these things are alcoholics of the worst variety. So, welcome to AA. Because I'm like you. If you're going to be something, be either the worst or the best. Well, I can't be the best, so let's be the worst, you know. And I you know, you, if you're going to be an alcoholic, put something into it. It's like, yeah, you know, drink, for God's sake. You know, don't just sip. Slug it back, you know. Just, I mean, well, that's the best way to get the effect out of it, you know. I was a vodka drinker. Pop-off vodka, which is terrible stuff. But it got it done. It got it done. At first, I drank beer. I liked beer because you could drink a lot of it and stay on your feet. You know, when I drank vodka, I didn't stay on my feet. I remember my father was always an officer, but he was also a diplomat and a doctor. And so I often frequently went places with my father because my mother was frequently sick. And so I would go to these parties with him with a long dress and heels and drink. Well, you know how that is. It is a total disaster. So I remember this officers' club. I think it was out at Bowling Air Force Base, right outside Washington, D.C., in this beautiful officers' club. And it has a round room. A round room. I hated. I mean, think about that. Where are you going to collapse? Where you usually I could find a corner and kind of be comatose in the corner until Dad would come to get me. But here, there were no corners. So I had to slide down the wall and sit at the bottom of this round wall. And it took him a time to find me, you know, because there were lots of people in this room. And I went to school, and I mean, I went to an English girls' school. We traveled a lot. I'm the only one in my family who's an alcoholic. My only one in my immediate family who's an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. He was an old Ozark coot from Missouri, and he owned hotels, and he had a place at the Lake of the Ozarks. And he kept his bottle under the bathtub in the bathroom, back under the bathtub. And I didn't know that. I wish I had known that, but I didn't know that. And he liked to play poker, to play cards of some sort and drink. And we could always tell when Grandpa was home because he would hit the tree at the top of the hill. That was the way he parked. He parked against the top of the hill. And then he'd fall down the hill, kind of roll down the hill. And my grandma would say, Grandpa's home. My aunt of the same family. My mother's sister was my favorite aunt. She was the first woman journalist, and she worked for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as a sports reporter. There's nothing better. I'd have loved to have been a sports reporter. And she was. And she was an alcoholic. And she died from alcoholism. She died in a convulsion after coming home from the hospital, she was she dismissed herself from the hospital without the doctor's consent. And she went home and had a convulsion and choked on her own vomit and died. And that's the way we die. And I knew that. I knew it. I knew she had died like that. And when I was, as I said, I went to school all over the world. I went in Paris, and that's where I began to drink on a regular basis. Because what it did for me was what nothing else did. Just nothing else did it. When I drank, my boobs grew. And nothing ever did that. Nothing else did that. My mother told me that after I had kids, my boobs would stay big, but they didn't. They just went flat as a flitter again, so... When I drank, they grew. I could feel them growing. I'm just this pop, pop, They were just like, it was wonderful. They made my hair curly. My hair had never been curly. It made my hair curly. It made me be able to sit in the back seat of cars with guys, do things in the back seat of cars with guys, that, like a guy named Bob Van Orden, you just wanted to throw up on him. And I was in the back seat of a car with him doing unspeakable things because I was drunk. And, it didn't seem to matter that I had chosen him that particular night. It was okay because I was drinking. It didn't really bother me. It didn't affect me that much until I started being on my own. And I was in Paris and I was drinking wine on a daily basis, and I was at school there, and it's funny, Tracy said, I love the color of your nail polish, and I said, yes, it's OPI. They have these funny names for OPI nail polish, and this one is called An Affair in Red Square. And I said to the lady who does my nails, well, I didn't have an affair in Red Square, but I had one in the Place de la Concorde. Does that count? They should name one after me. But I was with... People were drinking. They were drinking, and so I was going with this guy who was going to be an orchestra conductor, and I saw him, and I joined them, marching and drinking. Drinking was the main thing. And we were marching across the Place de la Concorde, and I didn't know they were communists. I didn't know this whole bunch was communists. They were communists. I didn't know. They drank. That's what they had bottles. Noel had a bottle. We were marching on the American embassy. I get up to this thing up here, the gates and so forth, and I look up and there's the American flag. And I was drunk, but I wasn't that drunk. I knew I better get out of there, because my father was a diplomat. So I called him, and he just asked me, I don't know how you are with your folks or your significant others, but they get tired. And I said to him, hey, I got to tell you something. I marched on the American embassy today. I'm really sorry. And he said, I guess you were drunk. I said, well, yeah, I was, kind of. I never admitted to being really drunk, just kind of drunk. And he said, were there any reporters? And I said, I don't think so. And so he said, well, that's good, and hung up the phone. It was, they got to the point where they didn't know what to say. You know, they were worried all the time. There were months at a time that they had no idea where I was on the continent of Europe. No idea. I'm just there. I'm out there. I'd call them once in a while and tell them. I went to school in Switzerland, to the interpreter school there, learned to interpret languages. And we were having a big celebration, and my boyfriend at the time was a guy from Scotland, and we were supposed to wear our natural our native garb, and I wore blue jeans and a pink shirt, as I recall, and saddle Oxfords, and he wore his kilt and his fluffy shirt that they wear, and his sporran, you know, that hides the family jewels in the front here. And he was redheaded, and I've always been partial to redheaded men. And so we were in the German tent, and we pushed a case of wine out the back of the tent and ran around and grabbed it and dragged it into some bushes and sat there all afternoon and drank wine and talked and solved the world's problems and so forth. And the last thing I remember was walking up the sidewalk behind him with a stick. And I was trying to flip up his kilt to see whether he had on any underwear. Because I had heard that they don't wear underwear. And like a lot of the stuff I did, I don't remember if he had any underwear on or not. I just kind of went, and I woke up, came to, out of the blackout, with an Italian. And I'm told, I just switched languages in midstream. You know, I would be, here I am with this Scotsman who speaks English more or less, and then I end up with Giorgio the Italian, and I'm speaking Italian to me, and he says to me, I need to go to confession. And he would pick me up in the morning and take me to confession. And I didn't know what I did. And, you know, it's not one of those questions you want to ask. Like, what did I do to have to go to confession? Because they'll tell you. And I don't want to know. So he picked me up in the morning, and we went to confession, and I'm in there, and people are getting up and down, and I don't feel good. I mean, I feel bad. You know, the brownouts, those days where you, even your tongue has hair on it, you know, that. Horrible. I felt horrible. And I'm sitting in this Catholic church and they're swinging incense and it stinks. You know, it really stinks. And then there's all these up and downs and up and downs and I'm getting dizzy. And I said to Giorgio, I'm not Catholic. And I just sort of got up and left. I mean, I didn't know what else to do. I wasn't going to have him throw me into one of these boxes on the side. I didn't know what they did with you in confession. I am not Catholic. But those are the kind of things that were getting bad. And in the end, I became what I never wanted to be. I was pathetic. I became pathetic. And you know, I'm a German. I could be a lot of things, but I don't want to be pathetic. Start a war or something, but don't be pathetic. Well, you know, we seem to start a lot of wars. But I got to the place where I was I cried all the time. I was always crying. Oh, you look nice today. You look bad today. Oh, you know, it was just, I just cried. I cried and drank and cried and drank. And by this time, we had moved to Washington, D.C., and I was living upstairs in the attic bedroom. And sometimes my mother would lock me up there because I tended to get away from them. And I was up there with my bottle. And I had bottles all over the place in those, you know, those cardboard wardrobes that you move stuff in when you move. I had my full ones in one and my empties in the other. And And I was up there, and I had plenty to drink, and so I was comforted by that fact. But I, you know, I woke up on the rug in front of my bathtub, and I had one of these old bathtubs with claw feet, and in a fit of decorating frenzy, I painted the underside of this tub with purple, and the rug was black, and the curtains were black. You know, I was depressed, I would say, and because I had decorated it, and I freaked out. I thought it was the devil. I thought, you know, because it has those claw things on it. Where am I? You know, and things like that were starting to happen more and more. And my sister said to me, "You look road hard and put up wet. We need to do something." So she sent me down and tried to frost my hair. Well, when you drink as much as I drank, it goes into your bloodstream and it goes to your head. The alcohol does, and it messes up your synapses. We have all these little neurons in our brains, billions of them, and they tickle each other. They have little arms, and they tickle each other like this. Scientifically, this is true. I don't know what the actual names of these things are, but I call them arms, and they tickle each other like this. And when they don't like alcohol, so when they're merrily tickling along and the alcohol comes in, and they go, eek, eek. And then there's a spark that's supposed to jump across this thing that causes us to think. Our brain is like an electrical machine. It causes us to think. Except this time that these things are back here like this. They're eek. And the little spark goes, and it hits the side. And so we get a fried brain. Our brain gets fried. Literally. And we lose a lot of those, I want you to know. We don't lose them all, thank heavens, but we lose a lot of our brain cells because of these sparks growing where they're not supposed to go. Well, if it does that to your brain, think about what it does to your hair. And she put this stuff on that's supposed to turn it silvery. Streaks of silver. And it turned bright bozo orange. I looked like a hyena. You know, I had streaks of this stuff everywhere. It was all orange. She said, "Oh, something's wrong. And, so she tried to do it again. It just got oranger and oranger. And finally, I just told her, "Stay away from me. You know, I don't want to stay away from me." And I continued to drink my bottle of rum at the time. Well, one day I was looking at my eyelashes. You know how your mother always says, "This is Mary Beth. She's our smart kid. This is Suzanne. She's our beautiful kid. This is John. He is going to be a scientist. And this is Peggy. She has long eyelashes." That's what she would say about me. She has long eyelashes. Well, so I'd put mascara around my eyes, all right, whatever, eyeliner around my eyes. It's dangerous when you're drinking. Because you stick that thing in your eye, and that smarts, let me tell you. Even drunk, it smarts. And then I'd put mascara on, and then I'd pass out. Because I was waiting for company. I was always going to have company. But I never had any company. Because it was kind of pathetic. It was pathetic. And I'd pass out on the pillow, and I'd wake up, and my eye that I had passed out on. The right hand side was what I passed out on, because your heart is on your left side and you don't want to pass out on your left side because you might die. Because as drunk as we get, the heart might just go, "Give it up." but if you're right side, you got your heart up, so it's bumping away. And I'm on this side, and my eye, I wake up, and my eyelashes are glued to my cheek. I mean, it's just like, I can't see, and I think I'm blind. And I just started crying. I just was sobbing. I'm blind. I can't see. I look in the mirror, and there's these, all these, look just like a raccoon. I had all this stuff under my eyes, around my eyes. And my mother heard me crying. Now, I had long since been desperate. And that's, I tell you, that's the greatest gift I could wish to you, is desperation. Because even when you're sober, desperation will make us do a lot of stuff that we will not do otherwise. And I was really desperate. And I my mother heard me crying, and she came upstairs, and I said, I was just sobbing, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. It's the first time I'd ever said it. And she got all excited and ran downstairs and got Dad, and they took me, they folded me in half, and slipped me a Mickey. They gave me some vodka with a Prozine in it and folded me in half and put me in the Porsche and took me out to the country and unfolded me on the porch at Melwood Farm. And I was there for 30-some days. It wasn't a treatment center as we think of them today. It was a drying-out place. We got dried out, and we were a fellowship kind of our own. You know, there was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. There was a wife of the Speaker of the House of Representatives. There was a representative there. There were some pretty famous people in that place. And then there was me. And you know what? Later I checked, and I'm the only one who stayed sober. I mean, and I don't know why. I guess because they knew there were some really sick alcoholics in Minnesota, and someday I was going to come up and talk to them. I don't know. But I don't know why. It certainly isn't that I, because they were really better, more important people than I. But for some reason, I'm the only one still sober. And I'm really grateful for that. And my mom and dad took me home. I got a job with the government. I worked for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and I was translated the astronauts' fan mail, and sent their fan mail to them in English, and then they would write me a reply, and I would write a letter back to the kid, and it was a lot of fun. And I did a lot of other stuff that was technical, and I did a little work for these people that presented themselves to me at work one time, and they would come once a month, and I would go off with them in a room, and they would tell me what to listen for at this embassy or that embassy, and I would get invitations to go and eavesdrop on them and so forth. So it was exciting to me. And I was sober. And I went to meetings. And my first meeting was one of the meetings that they took us to when we went in the little bus and the little van. And that was the friendship group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in there, and a woman walked up to me and said, "My name is Jane Holler, and I'll be your sponsor. You look new." Well, I was insulted because I thought I looked pretty good compared to what I had been looking like, and of course I really did, but I was pretty bad. But I know a new person when they walk in. Don't you know a new person? They look like a dog on the freeway. You know, they don't know what's happening. They don't know what AA is, especially if they come to us right off the street. What I love, what I'm really excited about now, is we're getting a lot of jail people. And I love jail people. They're exciting people. I mean, I have a meeting that I go to. I take a rotating commitment to a jail meeting now out to Sarpy County Jail. And I, you know, I love to listen to those women that are in there. They're just, it's just wonderful. We get to pitch AA to them, and they listen. And because I don't care if they come out of their ward because they want to be out of their ward. I don't care. That's not my problem. My deal is to pitch AA. And that's one of the things that I love to do the very, very best. And I'm excited about that because we are getting a ton of people from various penal institutions that are coming to our meetings now. And they're desperate. They really, really need to be sober. They really want AA. And those are the kind of people that I like to, I love to talk to those people. When Dick and I met Dick at the friendship group also. He came up through the line. Well, his sponsor came up through the line at an eating meeting. I went to a meeting every night for years. And that's what we did on the East Coast. That's Rich was talking, and I just love hearing that because some of the stuff he said and some of the things he did were things that I did, which means that it's the same now as it was then. And so we were having an eating meeting, and I was behind the potato salad, and his sponsor, who was a funny old guy named Buck Doyle, he was Irish. As Dick says, he looked like an Irish cop. He had no neck, and he had a great big head, and it sat right on his shoulders, and he laughed all the time. He just laughed and laughed, and he was just a ton of fun to be around, and he 12-stepped everybody, whether you needed to be or not. And he came through the line at this eating meeting, and he said, I said to him, where is that Martin guy? And he said, oh, he's here, he's back there somewhere. And then he ran back there and told Dick I was asking for him. And I wasn't asking for him. I was asking about him. But, there, you know, he came bustling up, and we stood behind the potato salad and talked and went out that night. We went out for probably 2 months in a row. 2 months every night, went to a meeting, went to Hot Shops. 2 months and every night, and we got married. And if it were me, I mean, if I had sponsored me, I would have shot me right then. Just shot me. Because that's not long enough to be sober. He wasn't even sober as long as I was. I was sober a year and a half or something. And he wasn't even sober a year. That's not, you just said no-no. That's a no-no. Because, you know, it's, you got to take care of your emotional self. And we tell people that. We always, as sponsors, we always say, no emotional relationships or attachments for a year. We never think it's going to work. We never think you're going to do it. But we have to tell you. We have to make it, we have to tell you that. Well, that's what they told me, and I didn't do it. And we got married in August, and this August we'll be married 46 years, so he said, anyway. And that has been, that's been really a wonderful thing. Because he's been my running buddy, and we have been at the door. And we left Washington, D.C., and I got another sponsor when I moved to Nebraska, and I had the late, great Jean Mulry for 29 years, and she was my sponsor, and I called her sometimes every day for a while, you know, and I did a fifth step with her so she could get to know me when I moved there, and she was just a great sponsor for me, and she gave me good direction, because I need directions. I need to be accountable to somebody. I'm way too right-brained to not be accountable to somebody. I got to have somebody that I report to. And I'm a military kid, you know, and when I report to people, it makes me feel better. You know, they take out their notebook and write it down, and I feel like I've reported to somebody, you know, and I feel better for doing that. And that's true to this day. I like to be accountable. And I started sponsoring people, and the lady who'd been sober a year said came up and said that she was sponsoring a couple of girls now. And that's the answer. That is the bottom line. That's the answer. Because when I pass it on, when I, you know, I tell people things. I tell Brenda something, or Lisa's in the back, and I say to myself afterwards, I needed to hear that. I needed to say that to me. You know, that those are the, it's a repetitive thing. We pass things on, and it makes it true. It is that spiritual link, that pipeline of spiritual sayings. It's not just, it's a feeling. It's a love. It's a connection, that we have a connection with those people that we sponsor and to the person who sponsors us. I think sponsorship is extremely important, and I believe meetings are extremely important. To go to the same meetings, and I have, Jane Holler told me that all the time, go to the same meeting so you can show up there and she made me go in the kitchen with Crazy Frank and wash cups. I told this morning. I didn't want to wash cups with Crazy. He was crazy. He was crazy. He was 6'9" or something. And she said, think of something to talk to him about. So when I saw him next, I said, well, Frank, must be nice for you being so tall. And he said, why? And I said, well, you're a painter, aren't you? He said, yeah. I said, well, it must be nice. You probably can paint the ceilings without a ladder. And he would always look down on me, of course, because he was so tall. And he goes, like, and Jane Holler was right. Jane Holler was right. He was misunderstood. That's all. He wasn't crazy. Although I still think he was a little crazy. He looked like Lurch, you know, from the Addams Family. She made me be greeter. I had to greet people. And No Gross McGee said to me, why don't you look up when you shake people's hands? Nobody even knows the color of your eyes. So I started looking up. I mean, I had to learn things. I had to be taught, right? Straight. Maybe 5 years ago, I am on the greeting committee periodically because I just like to do it. I like to see new people when they come. I like to see anybody. I like to greet people, you know, because I like to think I got to be a good greeter. And we had the funniest greeting committee. We had Manny, who was from Chico, California, which is one of the roughest cities in California, who had been interrupted in his journey across the state of Nebraska in a van, had been stopped by the state police carrying contraband. It was full, he had a van full of drugs. And he got arrested, and he had to stay in the jail there and then to the pen, and then he got on work release and he came to the meeting. They brought him to the meeting. The work release people brought him to the meeting. He was greeting. And then we had this little girl who was like a short little girl who had tried to commit suicide and then told somebody, oh, I do this kind of thing all the time. When we ask her about it, why did you do that? Oh, I do it all the time. You know, we're just the strangest people. And me, here's the old lady, Manny the drug runner, and Janet, and we're greeting. And you know, when we first started this greeting, Manny, he didn't dress up. And I told him, Manny, you ought to dress up. You ought to get a colorful shirt. My God, by the time we were through greeting, he must have had 10 colorful shirts. And I'm talking colorful. You know, we're talking palm trees and just bright things. And he was greeting people. And then eventually he was released from the state of Nebraska and from the feds for whatever. And he went back to Chico, California, and at least a year after he went back there, he was still sober. And that, you know, that really makes me feel good. Janet, our other greeter, is presently residing in the Salt Lake City jail, having run away and drank and gotten, ran out of money, ran out of gas. She stole a car of one of the girls in our group. She'd been sitting in her house while she was in Europe, and she stole her car and took off for Salt Lake City and got drunk and ran out of money and ran out of gas. And her mother, she called her mother, of course, don't we always call our mothers? And her mother suggested that she should go to the police station, that they would give her a ride home. I told her, I said to her, that was really clever, Sherry. So she's due back in town in a week or two. And I'm still sober. I'm still sober. And I just keep doing the deal. I just keep doing the deal. I need to emphasize again. You guys, the young ones especially, get ready to be at the door. Get ready to stand back there and greet people. Get ready to go to the jails and do those things. Because one of these days, I'm going to croak. I mean, you know, I am. I ain't going to be forever. Although my mother didn't die till she was 96. But I'm not going to last that long, I don't think. But regardless, we need somebody to pick up the baton. I started to say the French, which is pétard. Pick up the pétard. What's the matter with her? Pick up the baton and carry the baton. Be at the door. I want to tell you a couple things, and I got to sit down. I don't want him yelling at me over there. I am sensitive. Sensitive. Terry's looking at Dick, and he says, "She said she's sensitive." I've known him. I still see your truck. He bought this truck when he first got sober. It was a drunk's truck, I'm telling you. It was a little thing that had one of those funny fronts, kind of a bulbous nose of the front of a truck, you know, and this little box back. And that car has been through, I can't tell you how many owners who have painted it God knows how many different colors, and it's still on the road. And Terry's been sober 30-some years, and the thing is still on the road. But anyway, where was I? Oh, I know. About this time last year, I went to pick up my car from a garage, and I went in the side door, which I usually went in the front, but I went in the side, so we had some ice or something. And I got inside the garage. It was perfectly dry, and the guy who was changing the oil in my car called me from the back. He's a guy in AA. And I looked back there and stepped off a platform. I wasn't familiar with the... And I broke a compound fracture of my ankle. I broke the top off of my hip. I had had a knee replacement in October, and this was in December, and it jammed the titanium rod from the knee up into the hip and popped the top off of my hip. So, and I felt absolutely no pain. I was mad because they were cutting my clothes off of me. And my sweater was new. And they cut my pants off, and I was screaming. They cut my gray suede boots off. I'm yelling at this guy. He was a paramedic. I knew him. My daughter-in-law's a paramedic. And they were going to cut my brand new, I got this sweater at Coldwater Creek, and I paid $37.50 for it. I mean, I said, don't you touch me with that. Don't you touch me. And then he's, and this lady was there, and she said, "Don't look at your foot." Well, what would you do? I looked at my foot. And that's when I started hurting, you know, because there were bones sticking out of both sides of my boot. And it was bleeding like a son of a gun. Now, I'm a doctor's daughter, you know, I don't know what's happened there, but I don't like it. And anyway, it led to a long hospitalization. I was in the hospital for a while, then I was in rehab, and then I was in outpatient rehab, and it seemed to just take forever. And I was flat on my back for most of that time. But I learned from it. And one of the important things that I learned was without without you, I mean, they brought meetings to me, they brought meals when I got home, they brought me meals. I got out to meetings when I finally got so I could. But I wasn't on the firing line, and I wasn't going to the jail. You can't run away from the jail if they have like a jailbreak or something. If you're in a wheelchair, you can't do it. So they don't want you in there, you know, because you're trouble. And they got enough trouble with the jail people, much less having some crippled woman in there. So I couldn't see the fire in the eyes. I couldn't see. And I couldn't greet people. You know, I couldn't be at the door. Everything, you know, that I just valued so much. I had spent a lot of time flat on my back because I couldn't turn over. And I got depressed. And I mean, I'm homicidal. I'm not suicidal. I've always been. But I thought about it and I thought, "You're depressed." I thought, "Well, yes." So this friend of mine, I had always gone to the Alkathon. I'd gone to this women's, and Dick actually started the Alkathon in Bellevue, in Omaha, over Christmas and over New Year's, and I couldn't go. So this friend of mine made me this little thing out of cardboard. It was a little figure, and it was me. It had my head on it, my hair, my diamond earrings, had my red sweater and my black skirt. It was a little cardboard thing, my jewelry. You put little jewelry on it and everything. And it was called Flat Peg. And she took Flat Peg to the Alkathon and put Flat Peg in the seat. Where I could be, I was like, it was a sit-in for me. And I thought, you know, that's what I am when I'm depressed. I'm Flat Peg. Have you ever heard about Flat Stanley? Flat Stanley, that kid that the bulletin board fell over on him and smashed him flat. And he stayed flat for the rest of his born days. He was flat. He just got used to it, walked around flat. I was flat, like Flat Peg. And after he took that thing there, it just cheered me up. I don't know why. It just cheered me up. And I thought, I'm not going to be Flat Peg forever. I'll be up out of here. I began to get the spirit back. I got my spirit back. It took a long time. And I was really glad my parents had already gone to the great reward, because they wouldn't have liked that at all. They would have felt terrible about that. And so I learned a big, big deal out of that, is that I really do need to be with you, no matter what I sometimes think. I really need to be at the door. I need to practice the steps and read my book. I always did read the books and that kind of stuff, but I need to be there. Just be there. And many people get to thinking that they just don't have to do this anymore. They don't have to be here. They got it done. It's okay. They'll take it from here. It's okay. I understand you. I know. I'll take it from here. But I can't. I'm too bad an alcoholic. I can't. And then the last thing I wanted to tell you was this. Oh, somebody has a phone. I sponsor a lot of people. And I have one of these gals a lot of fun, really. I mean, she could be a lot of fun. She was always doing something, mooning people, you know. She was always doing something. She was younger than most of the people that I sponsor, mind I say. She was always always kind of up to the devil. You know how people say, you're up to the devil? Well, she was always up to the devil doing something. She was a lot of fun. But I never, ever, ever could get her to say the word God. Never could get her to think about God or read about it or consider having some sort of spiritual program. Or I just couldn't break the barrier. She'd go to meetings and in the last year, 6 months ago, I noticed there was something wrong with her. I couldn't put my finger on it, just noticed there was something wrong with her. And she was a little bit of a flat Kathy. And I tried to ask her about it, and she wouldn't talk about it. She just wouldn't talk about it. I've talked to her mother a lot in the last few days, and she wouldn't talk to her mother about it. So we don't really know what it was. But for reasons of her own. Last Saturday morning, she hung herself. And that's alcoholism. Because she had not been at a meeting for a month. She hadn't called me in a month. And you know, it kind of got away from me. Because I'm busy with other people and busy with meetings and that kind of thing. But it just suddenly occurred to me, I haven't seen her. And I haven't heard from her. And we had asked her, and, you know, nothing was wrong. And there was an event that precipitated this. And she got mad. And she thought she got even. I don't want to be in that position. I don't want to get so, whatever that pain is that I'm not telling you is so great that that's what I have to do. Because that's what a lot of alcoholics do. So if you have a secret that you haven't told anyone, or you have an amend that you haven't made, and in both those cases, I think she had those, please just turn to somebody. It doesn't matter who it is. We're all goofs. You can tell the person sitting next to you that you don't even know and you'll feel better just from telling them. But tell somebody, your sponsor preferably. And it, you know, it'll be like they took the cap off of it. It won't blow up. And you won't have to feel like the only thing that's left for you is to hang yourself from the rafters of your house. And she would have been sober on the 7th of December, 17 years. That's what it is when we have untreated alcoholism, no matter how long we've been sober. is a good lesson for me. I will miss her because she was fun. And she put a lot in my life, and I've thought about that in the last few days. I wish it were different, but it's not. And just like I was the only person who stayed sober out of that house all those years ago, I was meant to be here to do something. And just as Kathy took her life last Saturday, somebody's supposed to learn a lesson from that. And maybe it's me. But let's be at the door. And let's put out our hand to new people. Let's ask somebody when we get to be flat peg. We start feeling like that. Just tell somebody or ask somebody. Do something. So we don't have to feel that, get so bad that the pain is too great. And I know that's kind of depressing, and that's not the way I like to leave this. But I think it's a good thing to remember, because I believe we have choices. And I know that I have a choice, that if I get to thinking that that's a good idea, I'm in real trouble. And I wish Kathy had reached out to one of us. But she didn't, and we can't take it back. Can't pull it back. So, but I am cheerful. I'm a cheerful sort. And I am an enthusiastic sort, as much as my body will allow me to be, which has been this year not very good. Which is why I always have to have help up and downstairs, because I might, for heaven's sakes, fall again, and I can't do that. But I really am glad to be here, and I'm really glad to see many of the people that I've seen many times before. And I hope that you have a wonderful year, and that next year at this time, these very same people will be here and be sober and be alive. Thank you.